Coming up, Josh Olson joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. I am Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I got my first laugh. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Byrne.
Hi, everybody.
We have the snacks. We're working it.
We are. It is a little crazy today.
Getting people in and out. We're doing this in the, it's still 2017, goddammit.
Just barely.
But we are heading towards hope and 2018. And, you know, it's so funny because usually every year, somebody will have a good year and then you feel bad because someone says this year was awful. I haven't met someone who doesn't.
Good. This was an awesome year.
I don't know anyone who doesn't think that the 2017 was like a Twilight Zone, and
I totally agree.
And it's bittersweet. I've lost people, Jerry Lewis and John Hurt, and it's just I can't wait for 2018 to start. We were discussing New Year's resolutions.
As we
always do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that so often happens, I think, as you're an adult. You know, when you leave one year and go into the next, when I was younger, it was always like, oh, I can't wait for the next year. It's going to be super great. And lately it's been, oh my God, I want to kill this year that we're finishing right now. And I cannot wait for it to die a sorry death because I need to get on to the next one, you know?
Yeah. It's, with the net neutrality and I don't know, there's a lot of scary things happening.
So much is just so strange. It just feels like 2017 was surreal. Mm-hmm. I think that was what it was for me. I mean, like, I had the conversation over and over with friends. Where's the ground? Like, it feels like the foundation of everything is shifting. Like, after we had a big earthquake in LA, you know, I don't know what I can count on anymore.
I feel, you know, like as an artist, you don't know what to write about anymore. Mm. You know, that to me is what's unsettling. So I find myself going to the past, going to childhood stories or things that have meaning for everyone, things that we can all relate to.
Yes.
And grasping on to those things, you know, that we all have in common, because today there's so much animosity
and division
and you wonder, I don't know, aside from superhero movies, you blink and then something is in fashion, out of fashion.
Yeah.
So I find that I'm trying to be very resolute in that if you have a story to tell, is it, you know, I never used to worry about, like, will there be an audience for this story? But
right.
I wonder so much now, we're so fragmented that, you know, and then, of course, will we be able to tell the stories we want to tell. That's what I'm searching for.
Yeah.
And I know so much of doing the book tour was going around the country and having these amazing experiences in, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, or St. Louis, and meeting people and feeling as if people were starved for a kind of a human connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we head into 2018, I hope we can take. We've been on a roller coaster. I hope we can be a little more reflective.
So, do you do New Year's resolutions?
I do. Last year's New Year's resolution. I mean, I usually always, like, you know, try to be healthy, but I did succeed. My New Year's resolution was to not watch the news anymore, and I don't watch the news anymore.
That's amazing. I'm probably really brilliant for your mental health.
But I know, but what's interesting is I have friends, and they tell me the news. So I'm effectively like a 90-year-old person. So I hear my news from my friend, or I get a text from someone.
Right.
About what's up, or I see the
sometimes
headline on Twitter.
Me.
And it's it's enough, because I find that the news to me was just like a soap opera.
Right.
It was like you wouldn't watch it for a week, and it was just the same,
themes.
Yeah, they just would, in case you've haven't been watching, let me catch you up to date.
So, and why is it that you resolved to not watch the news? What was your specific intention with that?
Because I thought that, again, it was like cluttering up my mind in terms of what I wanted to do and what I wanted my focus to be. I didn't want to be in the cyclical, you know, thing where I was just a consumer buying into what is a soap opera and ratings and being one of the people that runs home and, you know, gets their potato chips and sees what insane thing our president did.
And what sort of results did you get from not what did you see differences in your life?
Yes. Mm-hmm. All I do is watch more movies. I have more free time to watch more movies with more commentary and learn more about the focus of becoming a better writer and a better director.
We'll see that.
And hopefully the universe will
reward you richly.
Will let me achieve what I want to do. And hopefully they won't take away all of our artistic expression, which is one of the things I want to talk about with Josh. Again, as a writer.
Yep.
You know, when I was first starting out as a kid and wanting to write, and I've said this before, the people, you know, I admired Dorothy Parker. And from Dorothy Parker, I started to read writers who wrote for The New Yorker and Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway. And then Hemingway led to Norman Mailer. And again, there was a certain kind of a path that you followed that you, you know, writers that you wrote. And so you drew your influences from them. And so I find myself again with not watching the news going back and, you know, it sounds a little old fashioned, but reading the books we're supposed to read and looking at the paintings we're supposed to paint and trying
and
to
having
sketch.
Your own thoughts about them, not having other people tell you what you should be thinking, coming to your own conclusions.
Do you do like a 5-year plan or
Never.
A 2-year plan?
Never.
Oh my God. I've been doing that since I was 5. I always have like a 5-year plan, a 2-year plan. I like to worry in advance.
Oh, good for you.
I'm like a squirrel. If I were an animal, I think I would definitely be a squirrel. Like running around burying nuts. I'm always concerned.
Making sure that you're covering.
Well, it's because, you know, again, we were poor and we were hippies. So.
Right. I always feel like 5-year plans are so restrictive. And I don't fence me in. I don't want to fence myself in.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm back on the things that I wanted to do when I was 18. Which is travel a lot.
Yep.
See all the states. Yep. I think I've got like 5 states to go.
Wow, you're amazing.
In America. Really? You haven't?
That's incredible. No, I haven't.
Yeah, I knocked off a bunch this year, but I've still got Montana and the Mount Rushmore and the Dakotas and I've never been to Maine.
I got
very close. I've been to Vermont, New Hampshire. So I got to go to all those places.
So are you going to work on some of those this year?
Exactly.
Nice.
Greece. Got to go to Greece. Haven't been to Greece. So those are all, you know, I think with resolutions, it's like, again, rather than sort of giving up something, you know, I like to do something more.
Resolve to as opposed to resolve to not.
Yeah. Like I'm going to really, really try to, you know, to get to a foreign country this year.
I think you should.
Hopefully by independent choice, not by being dragged out. not by being told to leave the country.
Oh my gosh. Let's bring
God
in Josh.
Bless us all. Let's bring in Josh. Let's bring in someone, a sophisticated writer. Josh Olson is the Academy Award nominated screenwriter of A History of Violence. He wrote the viral rant, "I will not read your fucking script." Wow, that's the first time I've sworn on the air. Creator of the hit audio drama Bronzeville. He is Trailers from Hell guru, host of the upcoming podcast. Everyone has a podcast for Trailers from Hell. And also my good friend. Look at that sweet face. Oh, I trust that. Welcome, Josh Olson. Thank you for being here. Now, you can wear, I wear the headphones mainly because I want to feel old-timey, but
I can hear you.
You can hear me, okay.
So.
All right. I think I look like, you know, sort of satisfied.
No, they work for you.
Like
it's
DJ.
Great. You look like a broadcaster.
Yeah. Thank you. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a thrill.
I always start with my favorite question, of course. What was the first movie you saw? Who took you to see it?
My first movie, this probably explains everything.
Yes, it should. It usually does.
It usually
does. It's my first memory.
This show will cure you.
My first memory in this world, as far back as I can go.
Okay, that's a first. I love that.
So, Volkswagens, which was a kind of car.
Yes.
I
remember the bus.
And in the old days, well, do you remember, were you ever in one? I mean, did you have, you remember
yes,
that?
Yes, we sold the Buick, and I used to call it the poor mobile.
I just got the book.
It could barely get up a hill.
I'm flying back east in a week, and I got the book to read on
the
airplane.
Let's stop the show here. Read the book.
Yeah, we're going to start over in a couple hours.
Go ahead. And we cut to the camera and the clock.
Exactly.
Yes.
So do you remember the thing behind the back seat in a Volkswagen?
Of course.
Which, what did you call it? Or did you, we called it the bathtub.
Oh, that's so funny.
I don't know what. And my folks would.
The boot or the hump?
They would put me back there and go do stuff. And I still remember, it was like this horsehair. It was not.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd have a blanket, and they would go to, I grew up in Philadelphia. It probably had to go to Jersey because there weren't a lot of drive-ins in Philly. But I don't know. I've never asked them. But they took me to a double feature of Help and The Russians Are Coming.
Oh.
So one of those two movies is my first film because
yes.
I was supposed to be asleep. But, of course, I was mesmerized. I remember – I mean, I just have – these incredibly vivid memories of the Beatles skiing.
Yes.
Which just, you know, I mean, just little moments that come through. And I remember a car blowing up, I think, from Russians Are Coming.
Yeah.
But that was literally my first memory. I have no memories going back before that. I had to have been 2 years old.
Wow.
So
I love that. Yeah, my first, as I've said, the book was also Drive-In. It was Romeo and Juliet. So it explains a lot about me. It was like nudity and great over-the-top music. And,
oh, well, you lucked out.
And I was in a cool car, too. I was in my grandfather's Mercedes.
Your grandfather took you to see?
Yeah, we all went. It was like we went on, the whole family went. I didn't even know what the drive-in was. That was like we were in, they had a house in Vermont, Fairleigh, Vermont. And the drive-in still exists, which is pretty incredible. But everybody was going to the drive-in, and I was like, what's the drive? I want to go. Like,
fantastic.
What is it? You know, and my grandfather said, I'll take you to the drive-in. So it was like two cars filled with kids, and then I
was fantastic.
I got to be alone with my grandfather.
We didn't have a lot of, there wasn't a car culture in Philly. I grew up in the city, so my drive-in memories are very few. And I do remember, the summer of whatever it was, 77, conning my aunt, who I was staying with, into taking me to go see The Omen at a drive-in.
Ooh.
Somehow, I have no idea, I'd read the book, and I somehow convinced her that I knew it was going to be appropriate.
Yes.
And I just, I so got away with it, because my aunt is not the kind of woman who enjoys a movie with a man getting decapitated in slow motion, but I was that kid.
Was there some consequences?
No, she's a lovely, in fact, I'll see her next week, I'll ask her if she remembers it, but no, I think she was just a little startled.
That was the social hub for me. I snuck in with my brother to see Jaws. We saw Jaws at the drive-in, which is so, it's like you wouldn't think it would work, but it still, it worked at the drive-in.
First movie I sat through twice.
Jaws?
Yeah, I went with a bunch of friends from school, and God, it was a different time. We had this funky teacher, I guess it was sixth grade, who used the movie coming up and all. Remember, I mean, that was for months. You were like, Jaws is good.
Yeah.
Everybody read the book. Kids. We were kids. We had all read the book. And he had found out somehow that there was a scene where, Quint shows you some knots.
Uh-huh.
And he was doing a whole session on, or a whole semester on whaling. So he used our enthusiasm about Jaws to get us to learn whaling knots. But I remember going with a bunch of friends from school. And we went and saw it. And I was just, I mean, that movie, you've probably seen it, heard of it at least.
I've heard of it.
And I was just sitting there, and my friends like took off. I was like, I'm staying, because those were the days when you could do that. And they started the movie again in 10 minutes, and they didn't. And I still remember, because I was this little kid, and I still remember this enormous, we were downtown Philadelphia, the Goldman Theater on 15th Street. And I remember this just like gigantic black dude comes, sits down two seats away from me for the next show. And he's seeing it. Obviously, it's the first day, first time, losing his fucking mind, as everyone is, like, God, but really, and I'm sitting there this time like this.
Cool as a cucumber.
Because I know, and I remember him turning me at the end going, man, you are cool. cool.
Yes, said, I am. I was
like, that's right, man.
We were talking yesterday on your podcast about what the emotional
alleged podcast
you're with our dear friend Joe Dante. Whenever I can, I drop his name because I love Joe. But the emotional impact of a film, and for me, it was Network, where I was like, "Whoa, what's happening to me?" I felt like it was unsettling watching that film. I knew something was happening to me. And did you have that same experience with films? Like, when did you know it was like, oh
yeah, no, that they could do things to you like that? I'll tell you, actually, I literally just my first strong emotional involvement with a film was the time I fell deeply, passionately, powerfully, irreversibly in love with Genevieve Bujold in Earthquake. I had never, I don't know, was I 10, 11, something like that? I don't know. And just, it was like, I wasn't, you know, I was going to start having those feelings soon.
Yes.
But that movie just kind of kicked them off. And she was just, I mean, she's just, oh, God. I still like every time I see her.
Have you ever met her?
No.
You'd probably die, right?
I would die. I remember when she was going to be on Star Trek, remember? And on Star Trek Voyager. And then for whatever reason, she ended up getting replaced by so bad now, Mrs. Columbo, the great.
Kate Mulgrew,
who's fantastic, who I love. But I was so excited that Genevieve Bujold was going to be on Star Trek, and then it didn't work out. But that would have been hard for me to.
But I
fell in love with her.
No, I fell in love with people, too. I was just saying, but they were strange people like Bob Hope. And, you know, like, I fell in love with young Bob Hope. And Hope and Cry, you know, like.
Sure. Well, he was funny.
Right, but I fell in love with him circa 1940s. He wasn't
back when he was funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was really handsome.
But not like cranky old, everybody writes jokes for me.
I always prided myself on going for the one that wasn't as popular.
Sure.
You know, that was like, oh, I'm going to fall for Bing Crosby. I'm going to go
That's
for
easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any schmuck can do it. Well, I guess I'm pretty, I don't know. I mean, Genevieve Bujold. Well, you know, Victoria Principal's in that film, though, and she's pretty.
That's right. She's pretty.
I went for Genevieve.
You know, I interviewed Richard Roundtree about that film, and I was making fun of the interview because every question I asked him, he just kept saying, I don't remember.
Sure.
And I have never done this with anybody else, but I never have succumbed to a cheap joke. But I was like, and Charlton Heston's in it. And he goes, I don't remember. And I, around the fourth time, I go, there was a really big earthquake in the film. Do you remember that, Richard? And it got like a laugh, and then he kind of loosened up a bit.
That's not unreal. I remember seeing Jack Palance at the American Cinematheque for a screening of Panic in the Streets.
Oh,
which
incredible.
Is, see, when we do the Trailers from Hell podcast, I can sit here with my phone and look stuff up, and no one knows that I don't remember. But I think that was that like his first or second? I mean, it was one of his earliest films, and it's like 1952.
Yeah.
And here it is. It's like 2008 or something. And they do the Q&A and someone goes, they ask him some specific question about, does he remember, you know, the day this thing happened? He's like, hey, man, that was 60 years ago.
Do you remember what you were doing at work one day 60 years ago?
Exactly.
It's so funny to me because it's like you're being interviewed and there's 500 people here and the film means so much to them.
Yeah.
Like you didn't prep a little bit.
Well, yeah, okay. But, you know, it's just some shit he did 60 years ago.
Oh, God. So I the point is I can't add any more background about Earthquake, and I'm disappointed because I thought it had a lot of interesting.
Oh, I love that film. I remember sitting in school drawing pictures of cities being destroyed constantly. And now I live near. I mean, I go ride my bike around the reservoir that collapses, and I go by Capitol Records, you know, where they have that great car chase, the George Kennedy beginning. That is such a great thing about coming, because did you have that where you come here and you spend enough time and then you start seeing movies that you loved? I remember seeing like a Buster Keaton movie that I'd seen 100 times, and it's on the Santa Monica Pier.
Oh,
the difference in
All you go up to the house where you know that they have in Double Indemnity.
Oh,
that
God,
house
yeah.
is
sure.
Joan Crawford's place and Mommy Dear. Yeah, so I try to, you know, I try to visit all the little sites. Well, we were at Crossroads. Like, again,
I'm Crossroads of the world.
I'm fascinated by all the, you know, movie history that we have here. Do you like Grauman's Chinese is my favorite.
I used to say that if we're ever going to get married again, I'd get married there.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, and then I got married again, and it didn't really come up because she wasn't. I don't even know how you do it. I guess you'd have to rent it. I mean, it could
I
be
don't
dumb.
Know. I would choose getting my footprint over an Oscar.
Yeah. Okay.
That would be to me. I just feel like that's. That would you've got a quite a career.
Sure.
When they that to me is the most exciting showbiz moment I've
That's
ever
pretty great.
Experienced.
Yeah.
And when I was a part of I've seen a lot of them with the TCM, but I was literally a part of the Jerry Lewis one. And that was like I'm done. Like I've accomplished one thing.
No, that's I've been out here for 37 years. Whenever I'm there waiting for a friend in front, you know, you always find somebody else. Oh, look how small his feet
I
were.
Know.
Tiny feet.
I grew up with that, seeing Marilyn Monroe do this, and it's just, I don't know why it's so appealing. Everybody applauds.
Well, it's such a weird thing to do.
It's so insane. It's I don't know. It's so gimmicky, but it somehow it works.
Yeah.
So when you were growing up, did you did you write stories? Were you a good storyteller?
I was a writer and an artist, and it was always going to go one way or the other. And lean towards movies because
do you remember the first story you told like as a kid like what
God,
were your
no but you know what my mother dragged out a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't even remember having written before last time I was home a couple weeks ago and it was all these stories I'd written as a child that were just ridiculous and I'd illustrated them too and it was fascinating because it was
amazing.
Well, it's like I'd never seen them before.
Yeah.
Which I have developed this theory of the only, you know, people go, what is success? And it's like I have only one definition and it is. It struck me many years ago, but that someday you are hopefully old enough, and it's not some sort of ailment that has come to you, but you've just forgotten everything, mm-hmm. and there's whatever a shelf of your works.
Yeah.
And you throw them on, or you crack them open, or whatever it is, and you look at them, and when you're done, you go, "That shit was good."
No.
Like that's it. That is the only one that matters. Because at a certain point, it's like, and you know, and the problem with, as you know, like when you watch. Something you've done, especially as a, you know, I think it's probably a bit different for actors, although you've got to be judging your own performance, and that's got to be insane too. But I remember History of Violence was the first thing I had done that was you know, good, I would say. But it was just sort of this weird experience watching it, and I remember speaking to, I'll name drop my friend Dennis Lehane, who had gone through, you know, a couple years earlier and had Mystic River, I think was his first one made, which was pretty good.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it, and he said, yeah, there's really only two responses. It's either they fucked it up or, you know, they didn't fuck it up. You, like, never get to go, wow, that's great, because you're so involved with it and so familiar with it, there's no surprises.
Do you know when you write something if it's good or not?
I mean, that's a weird word. I think so. I mean, I know when I'm happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you're excited about it, when something really starts flowing. I guess I've written stuff that I, you know, I sort of figured later was like, that's good. But there's times when, you know, it's just coming out of you and you can't get out of you fast enough and you're just like so on fire. And it's like just knowing that it felt that good. Always. Whenever I have that experience, it always ends up being good, and that's a good feeling. That's like is.
Do you have themes at all? Like I was saying to Tamara, I find myself just always the things that are the richest for me are nostalgic of looking back of my childhood seem more clear cut for me.
I don't know. I mean, I it's funny. I've had a, you know, people have read stuff I've written and found things in it that were not intentional, but that were. There's a great Tom Stoppard line about. When somebody does a serious analysis of your work and finds sort of themes and ideas that you didn't put in there. And he says it's like being caught with a pound of cocaine at the airport. Like you can genuinely say, I don't remember putting this in there, but you're going to jail. You know, it's like that stuff's there. I don't know, my dad, I've written a couple of scripts where my dad's like, are you going to write any more where a guy kills his dad? And I'm like, oh, I hadn't even occurred to me. My dad's great. He's why I'm here. He's a movie freak. I love him. But I've killed several fathers in scripts. But I'm not consciously. There's sort of things I'm more interested in writing about than others.
Yeah.
And there's always – I just can't get away from it as much as I kind of sort of at least half despise the whole – and it's been going on for decades now, the whole thing where everybody – who makes movies is making movies about movies. I was made by movies, so that love comes through. There was an insane book written by some academic in Canada There's a book about history of violence where they're sort of struggling with trying to figure out what it's all about. And the guy actually devotes several chapters to figuring out why it's the only movie in the Cronenberg oeuvre that feels like it was made by a cinephile. And he finally can't really come to any answer. And I'm sitting here going, I have a thought on that subject.
Were you a fan of David Cronenberg?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God,
so you knew you knew his work.
Yeah, I mean, and I wanted it to. I mean, that's where the sex scene came from, finally, because I had written the script before he came on, and it was just one of those things where I'm like, holy shit, I'm working with one of my favorite living filmmakers. I wanted it to feel like a Cronenberg film, and there was no way to get biological mutation into it,
right?
But I thought I can get some kind of this is post crash. I can get some of that kind of interesting David Cronenberg-y sexuality in there. So that's when I came up with the sex scenes that he at first rejected. But
how does David Cronenberg reject a sex scene?
Oh, I told him I was gonna. I didn't know what it was gonna be yet. I said I'm gonna write a sex scene that's so good you're gonna have to put it in here. And he said, no, you aren't. We're not gonna. I don't want it to be too Cronenberg-y. Was his.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then I wrote the cheerleader scene and the staircase scene, and they made it into the film. So.
Oh man.
And I gotta say successfully, because they're always pointing to his scenes that are like, that staircase scene is always, quintessentially Cronenberg.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what I was trying to do. So.
God, that's amazing. Cronenberg for me was always like, again, movies you saw in the drive-in.
So
I was traumatized by It Came From Within.
So Barbara Steele.
Yeah, so I stayed away from him because, it was... He always sort of scared me, and then he was acting.
You got to act with him.
Yeah, it's like you ruined my. That's like it scared me as like So when I saw his name, sometimes again his movies go over my head. I like the ones that are a little more linear.
I like Driving Cronenberg. Best.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I'm skipping around. I skipped ahead.
Sure. Yeah. Sorry. We're all over.
No,
the
that's
place.
Okay. So when you – did you go to college to become a writer?
No, not to become a writer. My mother's an English teacher. My stepmother's an English teacher. And I grew up in a my great-grandmother died when she was 104. She was a Nickelodeon junkie. Her daughter, my grandmother, was a movie freak. My dad was a movie freak. So it was always
– Yeah.
I made Super 8 movies when I was a little kid. It was the first thing I ever saved up for and bought was a Bolex Super 8. So that was always going to be somehow tied into what I did. And I did a lot of writing. Mm-hmm. First, I used to write and draw comic books, but the art just – I was never – there was just this sort of – it's probably just it was too hard, but I just I knew I was never going to be beyond pretty good. Mm-hmm. You can just sort of tell with art easier than some things. And I got thrown out of high school.
What?
In my last year. And then
skip over that.
Do tell.
I was a bad kid. I was just not a guy. I was that obnoxious kid who had like the highest SATs and the lowest grades in my senior year, because I knew what I wanted to do. I was like, I had straight A's in English and flunked everything else because I didn't give a shit. I was like, if I ever need to learn anything you're teaching me by biology for something I'm going to write, I'll go learn it, but otherwise I don't care. And I was just – I was horrible, and I had there was a situation with headmaster's daughter and the high school dance, and I got blamed for the fact that she got so drunk she passed out, and it was just it's great stuff. But
I love it.
Then I went to college for a couple of years. I did Temple University, went to the film program there, and had some really good teachers. But I sort of realized I had made more movies before I went to film school than while I was at film school.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, the opportunity that came my way was so slender. It was a friend I knew from working at a B. Dalton's bookstore before I got to college had a brother who was out here who had produced a couple of really small films, and he was gearing up to do another low-budget film, and they might be able to use me as a PA on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all I needed to just like pack everything up, drop out of school, and come out to Hollywood. And then by the time I got here, his project had fallen apart. But I got onto the lot of what was then Laird Studios, where Scott and Larry Kalizuki have their offices.
Yes.
And wandered around until I actually stumbled into a job on Masters of the Universe. So.
It's I always tell people to get a job as, you know, people always ask for your advice. Unfortunately, they never take it. But I do offer advice. And I always say to work for free or work for a PA. Get a PA job.
Yeah.
And because you get on, it's amazing with like just a little bit of knowledge.
Yeah.
You get on a film set. And somebody takes a liking to you, and you just are Johnny on the spot with coffee, this and that. And, hey, do you want me to drive him? I have a car over there. And it's like, boom, boom, boom. You're in, you know, making a...
Yeah.
You can actually...
Carrying midgets. Did I tell you this?
No.
Billy Barty was one of the stars of Masters of the Universe. And when he was wearing his Gwildor makeup and hair, he couldn't get up the stairs to the set. So he was a lovely guy. He was so great. And one of my jobs was to carry Billy Barty onto the set.
Wow.
The Billy Barty, you may want, after this show, go, I don't know if it's on line, but the original Alice in Wonderland, which is the British film, I think it's from the, I don't know, 40s. It's got Cary Grant and W.C. Fields.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw this as a kid.
And it's horrifying. There is a scene with Billy Barty as a baby, but he's little, like, it's...
Particularly tiny baby.
Yeah, and they're throwing him around.
No.
It's very disturbing. And I saw in the credits that it was Billy Barty, so he was working from, you know, from that, young age. Disturbing. If you want to be disturbed... Tune in and watch Billy Barty. So what? And so that was some of your tests. Did you ever pitch any of your? Did people know you were a writer? Were you
no, because I was just wasn't even that focused on that at that point. I was just kind of working to get my sort of head around the business and figure out what I wanted to do. And I ended up spending 7 or 8 years kind of doing that and getting to know people. But I early on got to know a guy who was dating a woman I worked with on several films, who was a terrific, idiosyncratic screenwriter named Randy Frakes, who was good friends with Jim Cameron. The two of them had come up together doing special effects for Corman. And Randy was the kind of guy who just loved kind of turning, God, what's the John Houseman line? You come in here with a mind full of mush.
Yes.
And he kind of liked taking people like that and turning them into writers. And he really just kind of kicked my ass. I remember writing I hadn't written in a long time. I'd been so busy working, but I wrote a short film that, and I was so happy to show it to him because I knew he was going to have the same reaction that, you know, they had back home when they saw my writing, which was to just fall down before my brilliance and my genius. And he sat down for an hour and a half, took me page by page, line by line through every single thing that was wrong with it. And it was the greatest thing in the world. There's 5 minutes of just sheer horror. Like,
what?
You mean I've wasted my life? And then there was like, oh my God, an actual professional is taking me seriously enough to tell me what I need to know and respecting that he believes that I'll actually listen to it instead of rejecting him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was astonishing to me that people would actually take the time to do that.
Wow. Yeah, and how do you respond to notes? Are you good with that? I'm
It depends. I mean, you know, I smile. But yeah, there's some notes. I love the process. You know, it's a collaborative medium. You know, I've got friends who are authors and people who have gone back and forth, and they tend to be far more adamantine in their feelings about the work they've done. You must not touch it. You must not. And it's like, you're a novelist. You are God. You are it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a collaborative endeavor. So when you get people who actually have something to kind of say and add, I love that. I'll take any idea that's good. But yeah, when you get bad ones that you know are bad, I still have a really hard time with that. It's like... There's just this sort of feeling inside where I'm just sort of like, you're killing my baby.
Yeah. Well, you always have to differentiate. Is this your story now or it's my story? That sometimes you feel like, okay, good note. Where's this going? Like, no.
Or then there's the ones that, you know, and a lot of them are, you have to hear, a friend of mine, a lot of people use this phrase, but the note behind the note. It's like, you know, they may be going, the scene's too slow. And what it really means is the scene should have started a page later. You know, they're not, they're having a response. You have to judge their response, not take their literal note very often, I think. But no, I when it's good, I love it. When it's bad, it's like the end of the world.
Yeah. Well, it's always the people. I mean, what about actors' notes?
I remember Vigo had some tough notes about the first draft of History of Violence.
Mm-hmm.
that were completely right, and it was just and they were in the sense of it was more of, you know, I had been hired. It was my first real big studio job, and I had been hired to write a thriller, and I was kind of going in that direction. And his notes, you know, his response to it was he wanted to kind of pull more into the kind of the character direction, get away from kind of like the cheap action aspects, which to me they were like. They were the notes you wanted. If they had been more like, can I have more fight scenes and can I do more fucking and everything, you'd be like, but they were sort of thoughtful, you know, how do we make this kind of more adult? And
right.
It was just thrilling. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I've had one experience directing a tiny, tiny little horror film that no one's ever seen or heard of called Infested. And it was a great, great time because every actor had their own way of approaching things, and some people wanted to talk about everything, and some people just wanted to do the job, you know, or do their thing, and then let me, if there were problems, talk to them. And finding the different mode of communication with every actor was a blast. I mean, there were you know, a couple who just wanted to talk everything down to the molecular level, and I was like, that's fun. And the other ones were like, I got this, you know, just tell me if I've been focused. And they were good. We had an actor who was like, if you want to give me a line reading, give me a line reading. I'm like, in front of the other actors? Mm-hmm. But that was a blast. And that, can I, oh my God, if I should send you this clip. Do you do clips?
We can
on our website, we can put them in your page on the website. Yeah,
I did, and this is sort of related. There weren't really notes, but and I have listened to many of your podcasts now, and I know this is a friend of yours who instigated all this. So Infested is my kind of not so loving assault on The Big Chill. It's like I just wanted to kill everybody in it, so I did. And my producer at the last minute, I bumped it up to the 80s, a bunch of friends, their friend dies. My producer came to me last minute and said, you know, we have a shot. We might be able to get Jeff Goldblum to do a cameo. What would be a good part for him? And I thought, well, we don't have a funeral scene. I think it would be funny to make him a priest. Because Jeff Goldblum does not look like a traditional priest. And so I wrote the scene really quickly. It's just this this monologue for this priest, a eulogy. And then Jeff Goldblum couldn't do it. I don't even know if he ever saw the. I don't know if he ever even knew my producer.
Let's call him right now.
You know, now it's in the schedule. Now it's happening. Now you're going to do it. And we run around. And we end up at the last minute, the cast Mark Margolis. The great, great character actor, recently seen on Breaking Bad. I mean, I used to say he could read a phone book and make it interesting. He can just ring a bell. Mm-hmm. And he came out, and my father was there for the one day because we had extras, and he had read the script the night before, and it was a thrill because my old man was there, and he was going to be on the set. He's like, the script's really funny. He goes, I don't know about this monologue. I was like, I don't either. It's kind of awful. It's like this really was rushed, and but we're shooting it, and you know, I'm sitting here thinking, we'll cut it. The scene doesn't matter. And we start doing the first take, and Mark starts doing the lines. And I'm not joking. I'm not making this up. And I'm sure not patting myself on the back. It was literally the phrase, this is awesome, who wrote it, started going through my mind. And then I went, oh, my God. And I looked at the script, and he's doing it line for line. But he found it. Mm. Like, he found, you know, the good version somehow of what I intended. And just, I'm like, holy shit. So, yeah, you listen to actors when they want to tell you something.
I happen to like readings. I mean, I came from a theater background. Yeah. And, you know, like, you, when you're doing a play, that's, like, for me, one of the hardest things. You're doing a play. I haven't done a play in many years. But it's like, oh, my God, we're reading this one more time. Like, I'm going to die. Can we just shoot it and go home? You know, you're there for months.
Right.
Doing the same. And it's like Groundhog Day, you know? You get in, you get your coffee, you get into Kazi, and you're doing the scene, and the director gives you notes, and you go on to the, and it's this very slow process. So things you thought in the beginning, 1 month later, you're like, you've got this whole backstory, and this, and you don't do that as much in a film.
Not these days, yeah.
But when I hear something aloud, it's like, I look at something, and I'm just sort of, you know, learning more to write. But I always say, what's missing? I feel like this is organic and he ties to this and he's a counterpoint to him. But as I hear it aloud, I just try to add one more element. Does that, you know, that I'm always trying to make everything almost like a perfect square or something. I like everything to be tied in somehow.
It's funny because I like the thing, and I've gotten, I think like the first time I realized what actors did, I mean, not from watching them, but from the first time you work with them and mm-hmm. see what they do to your work. I mean, I know some people's reaction is like, how dare they? And my reaction was, holy shit, this is amazing. And I now, more and more, I write for, I find myself writing lines that I know I'm going to cut at some point, but I try to leave out stuff because there's so many times where you just, you've written this amazing paragraph that explains everything, and then, and then John Wayne just looks across the room in that one close up and says everything. And
you're don't you feel like there's a process though? I mean, I get accused of overwriting sometimes, and like you said, you explain everything in the character. It's like, yes, but the script to me is a blueprint when you're trying to get the money for it.
Right. Well, that's the other thing. Yeah, it's like the reading draft or the shooting draft.
Right. So you're trying to paint a picture.
Yeah.
Because if it's not in there, then they go, yeah, why do you have that character then? So right. You're trying to enhance it to make it interesting so that somebody will want to be in it.
Yeah.
And then once they're in it and once you hear it aloud, but I guess it goes to trust of like, trusting. If you know films, it will change once you shoot it. Like
now
you said.
That's a really tough part is when you actually have to like, who is this script for? Because you end up writing, versus the version you want to write and you want to see. But then there's the version, as you say, you have to throw the stuff in for the people who aren't seeing what's in your head. I just had a wonderful experience. My friend Miguel Arteta is doing an episode of is it Room 42? Is that the HBO show that the Duplass brothers produce? And he wrote his first script and shot it. And he asked me to read the script. And it was really interesting. And I tried to give him as good notes as I could, but it was kind of, it's a surrealist exercise. And so much of it, I was like, it was so hard to give him notes and so hard to kind of, you can almost feel something, but he wrote it knowing they were going to let him shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote, and it's the first thing he's written, so he hasn't had to think about what we're talking about. It was just, I'm going to write the movie I want to see or the TV show. And I just saw it the other day, and it's amazing. And watching it, realizing what was going on in his head while he's writing it and all the things he intended and all the, here's this one sort of deadline. Yeah, but that deadline in this shot, the way he shot it, the way it's paced, changes everything.
Right.
And he had the glorious luxury of not having to sell it to me on the page because he knew what it was going to look like and he already had a green light. So
yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think the director always knows what it's going to look like. But again, it's you're using the script as a bit of a blueprint.
Yeah.
Have you had the experience? I certainly have as an actor where you are there and you're shooting it and it's not working. And what do you do? Have you been called upon ever to rewrite?
We did again. Goes back to sort of my love for actors. I remember on Infested, we had one scene that just wasn't working at all. And I had to go back and write fast because we were on a tight budget. And I grabbed all the actors because it was an ensemble thing. And we sat in a room and we talked about the scene. And my script supervisor was this guy who was an aspiring screenwriter. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, well, what would so-and-so do? And the actor's going, I'd do this. I go, great, that's perfect. And we lashed it all together. And I walked out and Tony says to me, he goes, God, that must suck. I go, what do you mean? He goes like, oh, man, they're just making up your, they're telling you what to do. I'm like, dude. Those people jumped out of my brain. I created them, and now they're telling me, because they know better than I do, what they would do. It was the greatest thing ever. I mean, it was an insane deadline we were on, but it was so much fun. But yeah, I haven't done much of that. I have friends who do that kind of stuff where you get those calls and you fly up to Toronto and you're writing scenes as they're shooting them on some giant film and the pressure of the world's on your back, and that would kill me.
Yeah. Like so-and-so wants a monologue, and he wants to... on some of the commentaries, some of the directors say that, and the scene wasn't working, so I called so-and-so and came in, and he wrote that monologue.
Sure, yeah, Robert Towne or The Godfather.
I mean, come on.
Come on, yes.
But then nobody knows it, like John Milius, right?
I know Robert Towne came in and wrote the scene with Brando and Pacino where he's telling him how to know who's the betrayer. That was Robert Towne. And Coppola thanked him at the Oscars.
So. Yeah.
But yeah, all those guys, especially those guys. Yeah, how many movies like Milius came in and diddled on, or Terrence Malick
give some great little advice.
Yeah.
The hello. We need a little visitor. You have a fan. with And then History of Violence was a novel.
Graphic novel, yeah.
And so what are the issues in adapting a novel? I mean,
they're different with everything.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, every single adaptation I've ever done has been something different. That was one where I loved the title and I loved the premise. And they kind of gave me license to take them in a very different direction and mm-hmm. tell a story that was more personal to me. So I did that. I've adapted a Dennis Lehane short story that is just one of the most beautiful things I've ever read in my life. I went to Dennis. I bought the rights. I'm trying to get it off the ground to direct. Mm-hmm. And it was it's a very subjective story. There's a love story, but it's this beautiful, almost poetic style, and it's kind of all over the place. And my script had to literalize it. And I mean, I understand why people read the story and then you read the script and they feel very different. And there is a lot of work that was done in the translation. But to me, it just feels like I was taking what was between the lines and being completely true to what Dennis mm-hmm. wrote. That felt like a almost literal translation, even though I had to do everything on it. I've done others. I did the first draft of Jack Reacher. Mm-hmm. And that was, I had not read the books. And it was honestly, to me, it was an opportunity because I knew that the Travis McGee books were locked up somewhere and looked like they were never going to happen. It was my one shot at maybe writing a Travis McGee movie.
Uh-huh.
So I tried to turn Jack Reacher into Travis McGee. You'll note my name does not appear in the movie, so who knows?
So you wrote, did you know you were writing for Tom Cruise?
No, he was one of the producers on it and a silent uh-huh. one, but it was sort of from the get-go, he was not going to play the part. And,
uh-huh.
That all sort of happened much later. I guess he decided he wanted to be Jack Reacher, so.
Are you a fan of film noir?
The film noir, what is that? Is that a genre of something?
Yes.
Are you insane? I said, oh my God, I always say this, and it paid off in spades a couple years ago at sort of general meetings. If I could live in a perfect world, I would write one film noir and one Western a year. And I said that to the right producer. I said to Warren Littlefield as I was walking out of a meeting with him, and he went, oh, wait a minute. And by the time we were done, I was working on a Western TV show with Walter Hill, who is one of my heroes and idols. And
oh, my God.
It was just, yeah.
You said the perfect thing.
I said the perfect thing.
Well.
But yes, I love film noirs.
I like film noirs because the genre is so complete. You almost can't not follow the genre.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I like about it. I love the morality. And I love something bad's going to happen. It's like Detour, you know.
Oh, I love it. I basically stole Detour years ago and wrote a script that was sort of my rewrite of it. No one ever notices. But
Detour is the perfect film.
Detour
is
so great.
So
I just
seedy.
Saw, I mean, I'm an insane person. I have this gigantic library and, you know, all regions Blu-ray players and stuff. I just tracked down a beautiful French Blu-ray of Joseph Losey's remake of M. Have you ever seen Speaking of Film Noir? And you sort of, how good can it be?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. It's so good.
He's a really interesting filmmaker.
Oh, yeah. But this is sort of in his early, where he's still sort of finding his way, and it's just pure American noir, and it's shot. I mean, it makes – I've never seen a Bradbury building used so well.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like a sequel to L.A. Plays itself. It's like it should show with that because it's just all amazing use of Los Angeles locations. And David Wayne is amazing in the part.
It's interesting just, that L.A. – why do you think L.A. works so well as a film noir town? Because there's so many dreams.
I mean, I think the obvious
here,
is right? like, you know, it's just cheap to shoot here at the time. But, there's something about it, right?
I always thought because there's nowhere else after California. It's the
you're
ocean.
Right, it's the end of the world.
It's the end of the world.
Sure.
And, so the stakes are high here.
Yeah, there's something about – also because there is something about where else can you go where you have those urban environments, but it's plausible that somebody could find themselves, you know, driving along the beach at night, like Mickey's.
Well, Florida, there's also the element of Mexico,
and
then, south of
exactly,
the border.
Exactly.
You know, again, exotic.
Yep.
Really, like hitting bottom.
Yeah. No, it's just rich, and it's there's some. It's kind of like living here. You know, you can go skiing if you want to drive an hour. You can go swimming if you want to drive an hour. It's. I think that's it. There is. You're right. It's the end of the world. It's sort of city culture. It's a foreign country. It's crimey and grimy and.
Oh my God! When you look back, did you ever read? I have a big book. I love crime stuff, and there's a whole book on the cases from the DA. Some of the cases here.
Oh, really? Yeah. There's and
going back to the 1800s, they're insane. In the 20s and the 30s, and then the whole studio days and. People, vehicular homicides and covering it up. And it's, you know.
There's a great crime history here.
Oh, my God.
You feel it. You feel it.
Really does feel like the, you know.
Yeah. But no, I do love film noir. I've been going to the Eddie's, your pal Eddie's Film Fest since the first one.
Yes.
Which he did the first year I moved to Hollywood. So uh-huh. I could walk to the
Film noir is really
Egyptian and
So I would be remiss if I didn't mention that you were nominated for an Academy Award. Were you surprised by this or?
Yeah, it's what a weird experience because you know I don't follow that stuff seriously. And, you know, I mean, I love movies, but I'm not obsessed.
The first line on your bio, it's always going to be.
Oh yeah, no, I know it's wild. But you kind of know when you're in, because there's all that, and it's gotten so much worse now. I have a dear, actually, relative who's going through the process right now, and it's gotten so much crazier in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, it feels like it.
But I knew there was a chance just because of, you know, not in a like, oh, I did, but the way people talk about it and the way they, you know, and of course you read everything obsessively when, like, you're in the race.
Right.
And I knew there was a chance. I knew that... you know, I was sort of at the tail end of, you know, it was going to be me or one other thing. I couldn't remember what the, but, and I do remember running into, I used to write at a coffee shop and I remember running into this guy who, and we were having a conversation and he was just sort of kind of disdainful in general. Yeah, not really, but it was just sort of like, oh, he's still doing that little writing thing. Oh, yeah. and he's like, oh, how are you? What are you, how are things lately? And I was like, and I remember, like, I'm doing this, I'm being a dick, but I'm sort of, and if it fails, I'll look like an idiot. And I said, you know, it's been a little stressful here. Kind of, you know, sitting around waiting to find out if you're going to get nominated for an Oscar. It's pretty. He's like, oh. Goes away, and it's like a week later, you're like, thank you, God. Because I would be that, I'd be even, I mean,
yeah.
Jesus, how embarrassing, you know. Because I didn't go through that, you know, with my horrible straight-to-video movies. I was pretty sure that... Hitman's Run, starring Eric Roberts, was never going to get nominated for anything.
Should have had his own own category.
But it's surreal because you know, and I had a great time because I was the longest shot, I think, to win. I was in the adapted category. I was up against Brokeback Mountain, mm-hmm. I got to know Diana Asana really well and Larry McMurtry a bit, and you're like, you know, and we all got kind of nominated for a lot of the same things, BAFTAs, Writers Guild, and there are worse ways to spend a couple months than traveling around the world being treated like a king and losing to Larry McMurtry.
Did you get to talk? I mean, he's you know, Larry McMurtry, who wrote HUD,
of course, which was Last Picture Show,
Last Picture
Lonesome
Show,
Lonesome Dove. I mean,
one of the
God
great
sake.
Writers,
yeah.
Did he ever say anything about writing? Ever give you any advice?
No, we didn't talk a lot. He was always just pretty, but he was kind of intimidating. But Diana, who he writes with, was lovely. We're still friends, and it was fun, man. It was a really good time. I got to know. It became this running joke. I can't remember the first show this happened at. Actually, I can. It was the Golden Globes, which I wasn't even nominated for, but Maria was.
Uh-huh.
And I was sitting at the bar, and Heath Ledger came and sat down before the show, and we just started talking. And then the next thing I went at, I sat down at the bar, and Heath Ledger walked up. And it became this thing where he started making a plan to meet at the bar half an hour before the show. And I got to know Heath pretty well for a little while, and he was
a
lovely, lovely guy, and did one of the I remember walking down the street at Fairfax and Hollywood Sunset one day with a young lady I was very interested in and still in the sort of pursuit stages, and I hear this honking horn. We're walking down the street together, I hear a honking horn, and there's Heath Ledger. He's like, "Hey, Josh." She looks at me, and I'm like,
"Yay, we're buddies." Wow. Well, that's always, I mean, that's, you know, that's always amazing. What about William Hurt? He's always fascinated me. He seems very intimidating. I was once with him. My only connection with William Hurt is that we were trapped in, I feel like it may have been right around the time he made the movie, but we were in customs. We were stuck in customs together in Canada. And he was very... very vocally upset that we were literally, it was like the middle of the night and we were sitting, and I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. I have him all to myself. I get to talk to him.
I loved him.
Cut me to shreds.
I had nothing but good. I was up there for a couple of weeks. Yeah, he's so...
No, he did not want to be bothered.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I know there's another side that people... I never saw... When I first met him, I was walking down the street in Canada the day before. It was like a Sunday. And mm-hmm. here comes Vigo and Bill walking down the street. And I guess they just decided to get together on Bill's first day.
Yeah.
And literally the first thing he does, he starts going into this whole thing about how... Ken Russell fucked over Paddy Chayefsky, and he always stands with the writer. And I was like, hey, all right.
Yeah.
And
I love stuff like
that. He's really intense. He's really brilliant. He's really out there. We used to play this game. One of the producers and a couple other people and I were like, if you were having lunch and Bill was there, he would start expounding on sort of the meaning of life and the world and so forth. And the game was, because at a certain point we'd all fall off because I can't, who knows what he's talking about. Like Groucho stared in the mirror and he saw the orange staring back and that's why we have culture wars. And you're like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
And the game almost became, how long can you hang on before Bill gets that you have no idea what he's talking about? And I always won. I was really good at just grasping enough of what he means, but I loved him to death.
And you obviously brought up how much you hated The Big Chill, right?
That was the funny thing because it would. I remember I'd been out there for a week before he got there. No, thank you. I haven't thought about this in a long time. And people would be like, "Oh, so are you up here? You're going to be doing work on the script?" I was like, "No, but the script's done. If you have a chance to watch Cronenberg work, you take it." And they're like, "Oh, cool. You want to direct?" You go, "Yeah. Have you done it before?" "Yeah, I did this one film." "Oh, what is it?" "Well, it's kind of my remake about it's sort of like I hate the Big Chill." Like, "Oh, that's funny. I'd love to see it." Bill Hurt, probably second or third conversation. "So are you doing?" "No, I'm not." And we get to that, he's like, "So have you directed before?" I'm like, No.
Good call.
And there's still part of me that's like, oh God, I hope he doesn't see this because he's so good.
Yeah, he'll call you up. He's because you got some splaining to do.
But he's great. And I remember sitting with him after the premiere, and I'm going back to his hotel with him and me and my girlfriend, who's an aspiring actress at the time, and the two of them. And she was just so besotted with him because he would just talk acting to her and such. And he was going home. He was going to do a high school production of Hamlet that he was directing.
Uh-huh.
And I remember her saying, and I'm sitting there thinking it, and I knew the guy, and I didn't quite have the balls to say this, but she goes, "Oh, they're going to, that seems really difficult. They're probably going to," he goes, "Yeah, they're going to fail." He goes, "They have to learn how to fail." He's like, yeah, he's right.
God.
He's kind of right.
So then after you did that, what were your next plans? What did you say? Well, the world's my oyster now.
I don't know. It's probably stupid. And I still go by this. I try only to do work that's I can be passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an early lesson with history that it can go well if you do. And that was probably a terrible lesson to learn because I've done a lot of work. As you'll see, I have not had a lot of stuff made. I got to work with I got to meet Harlan Ellison off of History, who was one of the writers who made me want to write.
Mm-hmm.
And that was complete mercenary. I was like, shit, I'm not going to be able to ride this train much longer. Is there anything else I can do to exploit it?
Yeah.
And I called up a friend of mine who knows Harlan, and I said, can you just find out if he liked the movie? I'd love to buy him lunch. If he's, just call back in 10 minutes. He's like, he loved the movie. He wants to meet you.
Wow.
Go up to the house, 3-hour conversation. Harlan goes, kid, I like you. You're my kind of person. And I remember thinking, on the one hand, you're like, holy shit. On the other hand, I'm thinking, well, I should be. I spent my formative years just stuffing my brain with your writing. And he called me the next day and asked me if I wanted to write something with him. And they were doing this TV series called Masters of Science Fiction. And they were going to adapt one of his stories. And he felt like he'd rather work with somebody for a bunch of reasons. So he maintains I'm the only person who's ever written with him. Actually sat in a room and we adapted one of his short stories. And Jonathan Frakes directed it for the show, and it was Brian Dennehy and John Hurt, which is, those guys are all right.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. We got to go up and hang out while that was being done. I had this amazing adventure with, one of my writing heroes, and we are best of friends to this day. For some reason, Harlan's very sensitive about his height because he's a wee little fellow, and there's nobody else on the planet who can get away with saying he's a wee little fellow, but somehow I can. And his wife will tell you, when we were writing together, she said it was like she would walk in the kitchen where we were writing around the table, and she said it was like a scene from Deadwood, because you've never heard so much foul, angry profanity just thrown back and forth, because we would just scream and holler and spit at each other, which was great.
And you never were you intimidated at all to?
Yeah, at a certain point, you have to not be. I've done it enough writing with people where, you know, I've learned quickly that you have to acknowledge the hierarchy at the beginning, and then you have to throw it out the window. Because if you're going to sit there and either go, I need to impress this person who's better than me, or I can't dare to take input from this person who's not as, you know. And it's just like this person you're writing with.
Yes.
And I think he liked that. And he also liked the fact that when, you know, he would scream at me and call me a fucko, I'd throw something back at him. He would not. There's the first time, I love that we'd argue about something and he'd go, I go, Harlan, what makes you think this is the better scene? And he'd point to all of his awards. And he'd go, those. And I go, I don't see any Oscars up there. And he'd go, you're not an Oscar winner, you're an Oscar loser. And he'd be like, good point. that was fun. I got to do a, right after History was, before the film was out, New Line was really happy with it. And I remember an exec coming to me and going, look, we're kind of sheepishly, we're going to give you some big jobs. We have this little thing, and I just thought you might be interested. Would you ever want to write a Western for Willie Nelson? Like, is there any, I mean, I don't, why are you asking me this? Who would say no to such a question? So I got to write a Western for Willie Nelson. It was a singing cowboy movie. All of us, I think, knew from the get-go it was never going to get made. That somewhere down the line, New Line would take a look and go,
I can't believe it didn't get made.
It's a wonderful script. My producer still owns it, but I got to spend the summer on the bus with Willie. That was kind of fun.
You have a Dennis Hopper story?
So,
please, go.
I know you said this is the first time you've cursed the show, and I've been cursing like a sailor. Are there standards and practices we have to worry about? Okay. No,
there is. The world's
this
ending.
Isn't that
there's
bad. But
no FCC.
So
exactly.
I get my first, I get my first draft in. Get a phone call from my producer. Willie's read it. He'd like to talk to you. What are you doing this weekend? I'm like, nothing. This is not my life. I mean, you and your Brando. But I have not.
I'm a tuning fork. With Marlon Brando.
So this limo picks me up, takes me to the Burbank Airport. I get in a private jet.
Oh, my God.
We fly to Kansas City, where Willie is doing a small tour of minor league ballparks with his buddy Bob Dylan. And Willie always stays on the bus when he's touring. And we drive out, and we're hanging out of the bus, and I get to go see the show, and I get to, I mean, are you a Dylan fan? You must
yes,
be. Yes. I mean, you know how, like, legendarily, he always gives the weird show in LA and he turns his back on the audience and it's like strange atonal covers of songs you've never heard. When you're paying $20 to see him in a Kansas City minor league ballpark, it's the Dylan show of your dreams. It's like, hey, what's him all on the watchtower? And I'm standing 5 feet away from one stage. Like, and we go back to the bus afterwards, and there's a bunch of people there kind of hanging out afterwards on into the night. And I don't know if you know this about Willie, but there's he likes to smoke marijuana.
Yes, I think everyone.
And so it's going around, and I remember – and Bob's bus is over there. I never got to actually meet Bob. I remember somebody came back, was like, see if Bob's up for meeting anybody, and Willie's wife came back and said, Bob's in a mood. Or no, Willie came back and said, Bob's in a mood, and Willie's wife said he's been in that mood since 1962. So I never got to meet him, but I remember going into the bathroom on Willie's bus and doing that thing when you're a kid and you don't know how to gauge yourself or anything, and I'm looking in the mirror and I'm like, no more. I don't even know where I am. I don't know who I am no more. I must drink no more. I must smoke no more. And I walk back outside, and in the interim, the time that I've gone in and come out, Dennis Hopper had been hanging out, or I did not know this, and Bob Dylan's bus. But you're in Kansas City at 2 o'clock in the morning on a bus in the middle of a ballpark somewhere, and now Dennis Hopper has materialized. And Willie goes, hey, Dennis, this is my friend Josh. He's a great writer. And Dennis goes, hey, all right. Had to take it.
Did you feel any – yeah, you smoked – I know. Yeah. I smoked
– He took a picture of me and Willie, though.
Oh, he did?
On my camera, yeah.
Oh, you have a Dennis Hopper original.
I have a photo of me and Willie Nelson taken by Dennis Hopper, yes.
He was amazing. He was a mystic, and I really miss his sensibility, you know.
He would talk about – I had one brief, very stone conversation, but he
– We get into something interesting, which is we were talking about yesterday, is this idea – and you don't have to elaborate on it, but again, this idea that part of being a writer – is, you know, you were supposed to experience a lot, do everything, therefore you could write about it. And if we're so self-censoring and no one has any bad behavior anymore with which to learn from, you know, we are human beings. Isn't this,
well, for all good, doesn't that mean everything we do now will be good?
I don't know. we're all going to be living in an Ozzie and Harriet existence.
Yeah.
Isn't the whole point that man is incapable of being good, that we are?
Well, you know, to go back to the William Hurt thing, the like, of course they're going to fail. They have to learn to fail. Isn't, I mean,
yeah.
You learn from your mistakes. And if you're afraid to make them, or if you're permanently punished, you know.
Well, don't.
I mean, we got to be clear. Yeah, I'm not like poor Harvey Weinstein being punished for his mistakes. That's not what I'm saying.
Right.
But yeah, it does seem to be a certain kind of, I don't know, I'm hoping it's a temporary kind of response to the situation. Well, again, everyone's very panicked about.
Right. The idea that you could, you know, be on the bus with Willie Nelson and, you know, whatever you saw, heard, experienced was in the vortex of privacy and artisticness of doing the film.
Right.
You know, and
now I'm talking about it in front of the camera.
But now it's like you have to be concerned that, like, did something I do in 1991, is it going to come back? And
you know? I don't know. I'm pretty sure that, you know, on a personal level, I don't think I have anything that I'm, you know, all the things I'm ashamed of are not, you know, actionable.
Right.
So,
well, no, just but, even in terms of do you self-censor as you write?
Because as I write, not really. In fact, I am sitting here today, I maintain, because of the exact opposite of that. And it's not based on an experience, but I had spent several years writing terrible straight-to-video movies. Mm-hmm. Hitman's Run with Eric Roberts. Oh, God, I can't remember. But I remember when, literally, I'm not exaggerating, the worst script I ever wrote got made into a movie starring Mark Dacascos, and I've never seen it, and I don't want to see it. It was based on the worst book I've ever read. And I just thought, what the f- this is not why I'm here.
Yeah.
And I was living, I mean, I'm not joking, I was living in a flop house about a mile from the Egyptian. That's where I could walk to the Noir Festival. And it was this house where a bunch of artists lived, and we all got rooms. And I don't know why, I'd never done this before. And I got really stoned one night and just started writing. Mm-hmm. And I found I could not plot for shit, but I could write hilarious monologues. And I wrote an entire monologue about a guy fondly reminiscing about having sex with his dog when he was a teenager. Not something I've ever done. You could write a movie about a mass murderer or anything. Nobody goes like, oh, how many people? But you write 1 3-minute thing about fucking a dog. But anyway, a friend of mine said, hey, we should shoot this. So we got some amazing actors, and we shot it on HD video for about $150. And without, I just thought it'd be fun to do. And without telling me, he submitted it to the LA Film Festival, and it got in. And it played before a Bruce LaBruce film. And so, I assume, do you know his?
Yes.
And it was a large population of homosexual gentlemen in the audience. Yes. And this was, they loved the film. I mean, it got a huge response from that crowd, which I thought was lovely. And it actually, it's a long story, but it led to getting to write and direct Infested. And that sort of kickstarted me writing better stuff. And that was about not censoring.
Right.
You know, that was but I don't know these days. I mean, here's a question. Could John Waters have a career now? Could a young John Waters?
Right. The answer is like probably not. It's really, you know, could you, you know, we're even reexamining scenes, you know, from films. And saying, what, you know, it's like, yeah, you know what happened during In a Lonely Place? It was like, I think Nick Ray, he literally had his wife, like he had his wife under lock and key, and there are all sorts of crazy things happening. And
but they're all dead
they
now.
Made great art, you know, out of it. Okay, before you go, because we're running out of time, give me a little bit of a through line on the story that I am fascinated by, the life and death of Jesse James.
Yes, and if you can figure out how to turn it into a movie, let me know, because I want to write that.
It's so disturbing.
It's if you Google just Josh Olson and Jesse James, that's a way to differentiate it from all the Jesse James stuff. It's a piece I wrote for the now defunct, essentially, LA Weekly. Well, I wrote, and it ended up in the LA Weekly. It was a cover story. Man, what, should I give the whole thing away?
No,
a friend of mine, a couple of friends of mine,
just a fun
were
story.
Very concerned about a mutual friend of ours who was had apparently fallen in love with a gentleman she had met online on the Deadwood chat room or message boards or something. Yeah. She was a big Deadwood fan. I mean, as are we all. And proceeded to kind of upend her life to carve out a romantic relationship with this guy. And it all, I mean, how much do you want me to...
It all
goes to hell, and this was before Catfish. That's all I'll say.
Yes.
But it turned out to be this astonishing scam in which there was no such person, and the levels of deceit that were involved, and the degrees we, her friends, went to kind of extricate her from that situation.
The most fun part of the story is the day and the hour and the minute you all realize it. That's always the best. That's the best part.
It's a strange thing because you're all sitting around talking about your friend, and there's things that happen in the world that make sense.
Yeah.
But when you're all sitting there and you're suddenly starting to realize, wait a minute, our friend who spent the last year and a half being in love with this person, I think this person might not actually exist.
Yes. Right?
That's really strange because she's not unbalanced. She's very smart. And that is a weird thing when you have to start acknowledging the possibility of something that seems completely insane.
Yes, I've had to do that many times, so I guess that's why I'm fascinated. It's like the person you think you are dealing with is completely nuts.
Yeah.
And I'm usually the first one to spot it, and that it's like food poisoning. Like, I usually sense, like, something about this person is off.
Yeah.
They're like, what are you talking about? They're amazing. And you know,
but sometimes, have you ever had this? I had this brief insane experience dating this woman who, long story how we fell into this thing together, but she had these wild stories of, you know, I probably shouldn't name it, but, you know, running this famous movie star's production. She was 25. You're like, how is she ran this guy's production company, and she was good friends with this guy, and she hung out with Prince. And at a certain point, I just started going, you're kind of nuts, and this is fun. I know it's not going anywhere, but you're out of your mind, and that's fine. But she would... We would go to these clubs, and she would always get to the head of the line. And I remember one night being at I don't live in this world at all. She took me to Hyde one night, and everyone's freaking out. I look in there, at the center of everything is Prince. And she walks up to him, and he's like, hey, baby, and introduces me to Prince. And you're like – and I'm at this point convinced she's out of her mind and making all this stuff up and just making sure she never has my ATM card. But it was all true. So you never, in this town especially, you never know how.
You never know.
Never know.
I think mainly they're crazy. But you're not crazy. And you are also, you're doing trailers from, when did Trailers from Hell start?
It's been at least a decade.
Wow.
I started, I think about a year after it began, my good friend Howard Rodman called me up, who does those, former head of the Writers Guild.
Yeah.
Writer of Savage Grace and other wonderful things. And he was like, oh, I think you'd enjoy this. And he brought me in. I met Joe. We got along great. And they threw me in front of the camera and asked me to talk about movies. And I thought, this is fun.
It's my favorite thing.
You've done some now.
Yeah. So I was thrilled to be.
We were thrilled to have you.
To be a part of it. I could do it for, you know, I love talking.
It's fun. I if you're ever, like, if anybody out there gives a damn, if you want to know what I look like when I am about a hair's breadth away from blowing a deadline, just look at any Trailers from Hell commentary, because I'm always, whatever it is, I'm always up against it. That's why I was like, screw this, I gotta prep for these commentaries. It's so much fun.
God, there's so many more questions I want to ask you about writing, but you'll have to come back. We'll come back. It was painless, right?
It was lovely. I could do this all night.
We had fun.
Look for Josh's audio drama Bronzeville on iTunes.
Yes, please do.
And you can find him on Twitter at Joshua R. Olsen. Thank you. Are you Scandinavian?
Yes. Skål. Swedish.
Swedish.
My favorite. O-L-S-O-N as opposed to.
Yes. Yes. I noticed. You can also buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper.
That's right. He's reading it.
Any day now,
come back with
from what
review.
I hear. Also, our website is ilianaspodcast.com. Take a look at our Facebook page. Like us,
that's
comment,
right.
Rate us, do all those good things. Thanks, everybody.
We are in the, when this airs, we will officially be in the new year. So I'm going to wish everyone a happy, healthy new year. And let's try to add a little love to the equation.
Let's do a little better this year.
Let's have a few more parties. Let's chill.
Laugh
let's not
more.
Kill Tom Petty again.
Yeah. Let's listen to music. Let's chill out a bit.
Absolutely.
Anyway, have a great day, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.